ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Why did Matthew Flinders write such saucy letters to his best friend, George Bass?
Who really chopped off Chopper's ears?
And why did they name a swimming pool after an Australian Prime Minister who drowned?
I mean, why didn't they just use Harry Holt's high school nickname, Puss? These are the kind of historical questions we'll be asking on The Dead Can't Sue.
Search The Dead Can't Sue podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Today, the Australian people have voted for Australian values.
The choice is simple for the Liberal Party: change or die.
The public are sick and tired of being ignored.
We need to have more Australian everything. We need to manifest a hyper-Australia.
We've always been about the planet, but we've got to make sure that people have their daily needs met.
People are starting to see that there is actually a different way of doing politics.
Hello and welcome to The Party Room. I'm Patricia Carvelis and I'm joining you from Wurundjeri country in Melbourne.
And I'm Fran Kelly on the Gadigal land of the Eora Nation in Sydney. PK, there's a lot going on in politics at the moment, but really, most of the big stuff is in Victoria this week. It really took the spotlight.
God's country, the Massachusetts of Australia, or is it?
Is it?
Maybe not so much anymore. Let's find out. Look, Jacinta Allen, of course, resigned as Premier. Ben Carroll took the premiership. He hasn't got long, though, Fran, to turn things around. Labor is going to the election at the end of November. Fixed terms every 4 years. You can't avoid them. We're going to look at how all of this is being viewed federally with our guest and fellow Victorian, which is helpful, Tom Crowley, very soon.
Oh, I'm overrun by Victorians today. On other issues, the Treasurer, there was a lot of focus on what will the inflation figures be, and they came out for the June quarter and the government breathed a sigh of relief because inflation eased a little. Still well above the RBA's target band, so I wouldn't relax too much if I was them. But the Treasurer was also under pressure over the fuel excise cut because it ends on Sunday, PK, as scheduled. So fill up before Sunday, folks. Already petrol prices are nudging $2. And Integrity
Fran Kelly encourages a stampede.
Minister.
Okay. It's okay.
Integrity has also been a major focus this week in the federal sphere. A real convergence of events. The leaders of the three major parties, and I'm counting One Nation as one of those, and Pauline Hanson, Point Piper dinners, ICAC mentions, flight declarations, all raising questions for the leaders, these three leaders. Money and politics, PK, it's a deadly mix and it's ever thus.
It is certainly. And the PM is facing a new threat, this time from the left, this time in his own seat in Grainler and not the Greens, because he's certainly faced that before. Let's get into it with Tom Crowley, ABC economics reporter at Parliament House in Canberra. And of course, good friend of the podcast. Tom, how are you?
Oh, good to be here, PK, and outnumber Fran on the Victorian front. I'll try and keep football references and coffee snobbery to a minimum.
She was a Melbourne girl in her youth.
I'm all over the footy. Don't worry about it, pal. I'm all over the footy.
She is. She's got Victoria in her veins.
Tom, yesterday the CPI quarterly figures landed and inflation cooled slightly, both headline and underlying, though, still above the RBA's target band. Treasurer Jim Chalmers described the figures as encouraging, with the usual rider that there's more work to do. But the actual news from that presser, given that, you know, CPI had sort of laid back a bit, so the government wasn't under too much pressure there, the real news was, I think, Tom, that the Treasurer was firmly insistent that the fuel excise cut will come to an end as scheduled this weekend.
We have always intended for that to taper off, so that fuel excise relief will end midnight on Sunday. And that's because it has played a really important role, helping to take some of the sting out of these cost of living pressures. But as I've made clear, and as the Prime Minister and others have made clear, it was never the government's intention for that to be permanent.
But Tom, oil prices are surging again. They passed $100 US a barrel again last week briefly as the US-Iran conflict flares up. Petrol prices I passed this morning on the way to work were, you know, for low-grade fuel, close to nudging $2. Why has the government decided to taper this off right now, this cost of living relief right now? As Sir Humphrey would say, how very courageous, Minister, I would have thought.
Well, yes, and they've sort of almost done it by omission. The wording over the course of the week started with, look, our intention is to roll it off, but we'll let you know closer to. And then there wasn't really a let you know point. It just kind of the words backed away slowly until suddenly they were saying, oh, yes, our position's always been that it's going to come off and come off it shall. I suspect that they thought that this was as good a time as any. They are aware, have to bring it back at some point if things take another turn for the worse. Look, I think these inflation figures, they are good news within the context of the cage that we remain trapped in the sense that we had, prior to this war, as we know, an underlying inflation problem. We had a sense from Michelle Bullock that inflation had not fully been vanquished in the way that the Reserve Bank and maybe the rest of us thought that it had a year ago. This was all before the war. That has not changed. What has changed, or at least what changed yesterday with these figures a little bit, is that the flow-on consequences of the war in its early phase are no longer as severe as we feared that they might be. And we already knew that as regarded fuel prices. They just didn't get as high as we thought that they might. And the whole world picture of the oil market probably wasn't as bad as anybody thought. The global market was more resilient.
And so they didn't hit those inflation numbers as RBA was fearing they might.
That's right. And then the second dimension of that is that the flow-on effects of that through the rest of the economy, while they were present in these numbers, for instance, building inflation, the cost of building homes was high, but the those second round effects of oil flowing through into all the different veins of our economy and the role that it plays, that doesn't seem to have been as severe in June as the RBA was expecting. And so that's good news in terms of what might have been worsening the inflation problem that the RBA was trying to deal with before the war. But it still leaves us with this underlying inflation figure of 3.6%, comfortably above the 3% band. Now the markets don't expect another rate hike, certainly in August, but possibly not this year. The RBA will watch and wait to see what its latest rate hikes are doing. But the government is being cautious about taking this as a victory lap. I think they were pretty clearly happy with the figures, but they know that, you know, one swallow doesn't make a
spring.
Well,
there's a reason, though, that they're happy. I mean, let's not forget, and the Liberals always mention this, but it's accurate, Jim Chalmers did go off too early declaring victory on inflation, didn't he?
The last time around. Well, yeah, but I mean, everyone kind of, I think, yes, about Jim Chalmers, but I think there were a lot of people, commentators, gosh, I probably said something around that point as well. It really did look like we were just gliding into the band. And then we didn't. Data centres are part of that story. It's something that we're still coming to terms with. But yes, it surprised everyone.
And also, I mean, you know, the government could have kept all of us happy and kept that fuel excise subsidy in place, but it's very expensive, isn't it, Tom?
Very, very expensive. And every additional month, adds a not inconsiderable sum. And so I think that they did need a climb down at some point on that. And I'm not sure they were getting a heap of political benefit anymore, even out of this fuel excise discount. I don't sense it was something that people were thanking them for or, you know, demanding that it must continue, that maybe they've law of diminishing returns with this stuff, and they are starting to think a little bit about that, the bottom line impact that all these subsidies have.
Well, yeah, and they're under no political pressure either. I mean, the opposition hasn't been calling for it to be extended or anything. That helps them, doesn't it?
Totally.
And the government tried to switch the message to fuel security and building resilience, and the PM was photographed over in WA with the Premier Roger Cook in Karratha announcing a $4 million pre-feasibility study into what could be Australia's first new oil refinery since the 60s, and that would be in collaboration with a chemical company called Perdaman. That would be a big move. It's very early days. And even if it does go ahead, it wouldn't be up and running much before a decade, I think I read. So it's no fix for petrol prices. But it's just the government trying to give the message that we've got our hands on all the possible levers here, folks, and we're looking to your future, secure your future.
Yeah, I think that's right. It's one of these. I mean, this is one of the knock-on effects of what was probably a little bit of a panic. I think we can say that in the early stages of the war about what all of this would mean for our resilience and our fuel security. And the government sort of scrambled and said, we're going to spend billions of dollars, and this is just one tiny fraction of that, on trying to, you know, shore up our storage capacity for fuel and go and, you know, underwrite contracts around the world and all that sort of thing. And all of these things that in the end, I mean, maybe the underwriting worked and you could argue that, but now we're left kind of spending all this money to build up oil reserves that in the end actually held up pretty well through the first couple of months of this war. And so, look, this is an oil refinery. It seems it would mostly have to use imported crude oil anyway. So I'm not certain in that sense how much more resilient it makes us to global oil pressures if that is the case.
Yeah, but that's right.
Early days.
And look, as I said at the start, really Victoria and Spring Street, which is where the parliament is, there in Melbourne, was where all the political action, the big headlines were this week. The Premier, Jacinta Allen, then Premier, was forced to resign after she lost the confidence of her party room. In the end, she appeared to accept the inevitable after a fair bit of pushing. She stepped down before, but not without a parting shot.
I was prepared to put my record and my plan to a ballot of members, as our rules allow. I believe I would have won. But doing so this close to an election takes up valuable resources, including the most precious of one, time. More importantly, it puts the state in a position of uncertainty. That hurts the Victorian people, and I just won't do that.
And then the real chaos started. There was yelling in caucus, audible from the hallways apparently, and then the Premier signed the ballot for another leadership contender after she'd pledged a support to her deputy, Ben Carroll, who'd already put his hand up. It all got very messy. Jacinta Allen was right in the thick of it. Ultimately, Ben Carroll, her deputy, did emerge as the new Premier with unanimous support. PK, you're down there watching it all up very close and personal. It was very, very messy. In the end, is it the right thing?
Look, it is. It's a funny question. The is it a right thing? I mean, it's a good question. Thank you. But is it the right thing? It depends what your metrics for right are, right? Will it give Labor a better, and I just say better, not good, better chance at saving some of its seats to a complete potential wipeout? Yes. Yes, not because Ben Carroll is some kind of rock star candidate. He is not. I don't think he is. I think he's quite a wooden performer. You know, he has some questions around him too. He was, of course, in the cabinet for 12 years. So
why
that's a long time.
Why do they call him Kmart Keating?
Well, he worked at Kmart. So, yeah, and his first picture opportunity was straight back to Kmart. And, you know, I've had a few people say to me, why did he do that? And I'm like, well, it's about coding, right? He's trying to say, I'm on your side. The threat from One Nation is coming. I'm an ordinary person who worked at Kmart,
right,
like, for years. You know what I mean? Like, I'm not some snob. And he is. He's a working class guy, right? Like, this is true. Although he has been a cabinet minister in the Andrews and Allen governments for 12 years, Fran. So he's not like a nobody. Mm. So you say, was this a good thing? Well, somebody needed to cauterize the problem, didn't they? I mean, you know, they were bleeding. Mm. They were refusing to call the Royal Commission into the big build and the allegations of corruption with the CFMEU. That was just one of many issues that's dogged them, but the biggest one, I think. And he was able to define himself differently to Jacinta Allen and Daniel Andrews. His first remarks, and I'm going to throw this to you, Tom, were, I'm not Jacinta Allen, I'm not Daniel Andrews.
Let me make one thing very clear. I am not Daniel Andrews. I am not Jacinta Allen. I will do things differently because different times require a new approach. I was born and raised in the northwestern suburbs of Melbourne. I understand the value of hard work and ensuring that every family has a chance to get ahead.
A few people have commented, and I think it's an excellent point. You know, who is he though? Like, he can say he's not that. And already the Liberal Party, and I know this because my lovely 17-year-old pointed this out to me, like, sort of using that framing to say he didn't stand up to Jacinta Allen, he didn't stand up to Daniel Andrews. Will he stand up for you? So you can see where this campaign is going. They're going to still link him to all of the things that people did not like about those governments. And Tom, you know, the federal Labor Party, I can assure you and everyone, but the federal Labor Party is watching this very closely.
Absolutely. I mean, look, I agree with you that I don't think, I mean, I don't think anyone would think that simply by standing up at a press conference and basically potting your predecessors, not just saying you're not them, but also basically rattling off the three biggest criticisms of the government, integrity, crime and debt, and essentially saying, you know, Dave Hughes and co, you were right, and I'm going to do an about face on all three of these things. Of course, that's not going to fix every problem immediately, but it just, I mean, it remains the case that he's not Jacinta Allen and he's not Daniel Andrews. And I think if you view it from the Liberal side of things and ask them, would they be rather running against Ben Carroll or Jacinta Allen, it's an obvious answer. I think they had to try. I sense that what their internal polling, and this is what people in Victoria and in the Carroll camp have been saying to me this week, that things were just looking, I think, maybe grimmer than we realise, and
Bill
more.
Bill Shorten said that they were heading for an extinction level event.
But I think at the moment, as much as people don't want to hear this in Labor, I think they were facing extinction level results worse than 1992 when Jeff Kennett wiped out Labor then. And I think the results could have been worse than that. So I understand why people acted. I mean, I understand at a distance. Having said that, I think he can move them from the low 20s to at least into the mid 30s.
Most pertinently, perhaps an extinction level event in the suburban rail loop belt, the outer suburban ring of Melbourne. And this is the old red wall that, and we've seen this phenomenon in sort of populist rises around the world, that previously safe, progressive working class seats have gone to right-wing populist parties. And both Matthew Guy and Peter Dutton have tried this strategy. Remember how much time Peter Dutton spent in the electorates of Hawke and Gorton in Melbourne's outer west and in Bruce on the other side of the city, really thinking that this was territory that he was making inroads in. I think what Labor people have been saying for a long time is that he and Matthew Guy had the right strategy, but they were the wrong people to execute the strategy, and that these voters were never going to be Liberals. But now One Nation might well succeed with exactly that playbook. They are terrified about that.
Yeah, they are terrified, and it's, genuinely a live option. You know, when the Liberals, when you raise it with the Liberals and you say, oh, you're going to have to govern with One Nation, and they're like, no, we can do this alone and blah, blah, blah. They're also worried. It's not made up stuff. Everyone is worried in all of those mainstream political parties, Labor and Liberal, about, the three-cornered races and how they're going to play out, right? And many people are saying kind of Victoria's the canary in the coal mine, aren't they, in terms of what is this new kind of splintered right-wing vote going to produce?
That's right. I want to sketch out the kind of the most, I say frightening, just the most chaotic scenario that I think is entirely plausible here. So Redbridge did one of these seat-by-seat polls for Trades Hall in Victoria, which was reported in the Fin. There's been a bit of goings-on between different election nerds talking about preference assumptions and all that sort of thing. And Ben Rowie, the independent pollster, wrote a blog post saying, look, the Redbridge preferences seem to have Liberal votes favouring Labor over One Nation, and perhaps that's not what we would expect to happen when we look at things like South Australia. And he sketched out an alternative if you take a slightly different preference flow. We don't need to get into the entrails, but just take this as a possible, plausible scenario under some assumptions that aren't crazy. And he spits out for the Victorian election a result where basically all three of the contenders have about 30 seats. That is what on earth happens if that's the election
what
result?
What on earth happens? Well, I mean, if I notice that the Prime Minister, from the Prime Minister down, every Labor federal cabinet minister that gets a chance is saying, of course, we support Ben Carroll and Victorian Labor and, just watch the alternative, the chaos of Liberal and One Nation. And so they're trying to get that message across. And, the word Pika, I heard you talking about this, I think it was with Raf during the week, how privately federal Labor people are saying, of course we want Labor to win in Victoria, but if they lose, it's not the worst thing because people will get a real life experience of what it's like to have One Nation governing with the coalition, and it'll be a mess and that'll work well for us. I mean, Tom, I'm interested to hear what your take is on that. And of course, the alternative could be true too. It might happen and then it works and then people get used to the idea and, that might backfire. But what are you hearing about this?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think that the Liberals are very aware, and all of this evasiveness about not wanting to entertain the question of coalition makes a whole lot of sense for them because, of course, they want to focus on trying to – I think they recognise a difference privately between a scenario where, for instance, you know, they might have 40% of the seats themselves. They are obviously the largest party. And then One Nation, almost Nats style, you know, if One Nation cleaned up a few of the national regional seats and picked some up in the outer suburbs, they might be entitled to a couple of cabinet positions. And perhaps that is a little ungainly, but it can work because it's clear who's in charge. But the plausible scenarios where they are on much more even billing. I mean, how can you, I just, particularly in state governments, which are service delivery governments, the idea of a cabinet with half of them being, you know, kind of Liberal politicians who've been around for a while and been shadows, and then half of them being One Nation people who at this point haven't been pre-selected and presumably are going to be very green, that does risk a form of chaos. But then equally, I mean, you know, what is the alternative? Because Labor wouldn't have, it's not as if Labor would be on the cusp of governing either, being so far back. And so even thirds, even when we look to Europe and sort of multilateral democracies with lots of different parties, I can't think of too many systems with an even three-way split. But not just in Victoria, but federally, New South Wales, when you look at just the primary vote polling, gee, the three parties are all within a stone's throw of each other,
yeah,
aren't they?
Yeah,
but it's interesting. I mean, if that were to play out, you know, that would be an endorsement, though, of the right-wing side of politics, right? Like, to be fair, if it's a third, you know, it would mean that people want
that's true.
Side of politics to be
they don't
in
want
power,
Labor, yeah.
Right?
Definitely clear. Vote against the incumbent Labor government for sure.
So they'd have to make it work. I mean, I've said this the whole time and I'm like really going to die on this hill. As a politician, you have to deal with the cards that the voters give you. And so people can ask the Liberals, and I think it's a reasonable question. I've asked it myself 100 times, but, you know, are you prepared to govern with One Nation? But the hardcore truth is, of course, they have to, if that's what the numbers deliver. Like, they have no choice. You can try and be all sort of morally superior, but, you know, you have to actually respect what voters produce. You know, like, I really believe it. Same, by the way, on the left side of politics. If lots of Green seats are delivered, Labor has to deal with that. They can keep telling you before an election, no, we're against governing with the Greens. They have to, though, if that's what the public decides. And so that's why the public has a big decision to make, I think. You know, like, do they want that? And it's reasonable for it to be pointed out to them. Hey, just want to get you, before we move on a couple of things that I think are really important. Of course, mentioned the Royal Commission that Ben Carroll announced. It's going to be a Victorian Royal Commission. He says the terms of reference will be very wide. So that's what he says. But then there are questions about, should it be wider? I mean, Tim Wilson saying it should be a national one looking at the CFMEU. I spoke to Nick McKenzie, who's the reporter who broke a lot of these stories about the big build, and he says it should actually be focused around Victoria and be really non-partisan, not sort of someone who hates the Labor Party that the Liberals appoint as the Royal Commissioner, not somebody, you know, who the Labor Party knows likes unions, like somebody who is genuinely not attached to either of the political sides.
Of course it should be.
I mean, no, it's like the statement of the bleeding obvious, but it doesn't always happen.
Well, it doesn't, and that probably is a distinction between a Royal Commission, and this was part of the thinking as well, a Royal Commission that Labor starts itself versus what might happen if the Liberals or One Nation were to win the election and then set up the Royal Commission. So I think that's true. I guess I agree with Nick McKenzie that I don't think it's likely or necessarily all that helpful that this spreads into a national Royal Commission. But there are questions for the federal government, particularly, I think, the decision to allocate an extra $3.8 billion to the suburban rail loop in this budget. It's been reported that was pretty contentious around the cabinet table and that Catherine King, the transport minister, was maybe having some reservations about doing that. Obviously, the government, federal government, trying to be careful with its infrastructure dollars, didn't proceed with Inland Rail. But Anthony Albanese was really keen to defend Jacinta Allan on this project. All of this big build corruption noise, I would say noise, you know, but like all of this conversation was around when the federal cabinet was having that discussion. So how seriously did they take the idea that federal money might be going into the hands of organised crime?
And also, what's the risk that in not just the fact that they put this money in, is there any kind of spread, if you like, that could affect the federal government and any of the ministers within the government once they start delving into the construction union, the behaviour in the construction industry that Nick McKenzie unearthed with those in the Nine newspaper investigations. I mean, that any of that might sort of come back to entrap in the spider's web, if you like, some of the federal government.
Absolutely. And I think that there is, I mean, it is one of those things that, and Ben Carroll essentially admits this in the press conference, that just has a stench about it. And so, yeah, I do think that a detailed and balanced probe of this will be useful and we will learn a lot. Gee, it'll make for good theatre. I wonder if Dan Andrews will wear the North Face jacket in the dock, PK, if you're saying he's gonna be there.
Because I don't think it's going to be a happy day for anyone in the Labor Party the day that they are ultimately, you know, going to sit in that chair and have to answer questions. Although, my God, ratings will be high that day.
Exactly. PK, just before we leave the whole Victorian leadership brawl, I just want to ask you the question, because I know you think about, you've been thinking about this, and whether there was a gender issue here. You know, Jacinta Allen, when she gave that exit speech, said she didn't want being rolled to dissuade other women from entering politics.
I'm proud to be Victoria's second female premier. And there have absolutely been moments when it's been hard and it's been personal. But the chance to make a difference was worth it. And if you're a woman making your start in politics, let me say this to you today. Please don't look at what I have experienced this week and think, stuff that, I don't want to be involved. Look at the support I've experienced over my career and think, I can make a difference here too.
Gender, I don't think, probably was at the core of this at all, but there was a lot of misogyny throughout her campaign and sexism. We commented on here on the podcast one week about those Ditch the Witch billboards, which featured the Premier's face, photoshopped with a witch's hat. You know, it's a key example. Oppositions and governments have a record of installing female leaders when the governments are running out of puff. You know, if you think about it, Joan Kerner in Victoria, Carmen Lawrence in WA, that's all ancient history. Anna Bligh in Queensland, Christina Keneally in New South Wales. I think they call it a hospital pass in footy parlance.
Susan Lee in federal parliament.
Susan Lee from the coalition. So, you know, it's not unknown, but is there a gender lens to be looked through here?
Yeah, of course there is. This is the issue that we have in a very, very binary kind of culture, you know, that you got to choose a lane. You can be in both lanes. Jacinta Allen clearly has questions, which clearly a Royal Commission will ask her to answer on, you know, the way she conducted her time as the Minister for Hard Hats, right? Like, and then Premier. Absolutely. But at the same time, she did face a very misogynist campaign against her that culminated in the Ditch the Witch, literally, stuff that was, you know, put on those billboards, which is pretty gross. Like, my girls saw that. Like, I think that's just disgusting, right? Like, that's just, yeah, I'm literally speechless. It's so disgusting. Julia Gillard has intervened and, you know, obviously they're in the same part of the left, right? Like the left of the Labor Party. Remember, Julia Gillard is also a Victorian, just a bit of context there. But I think her as, in many ways, you'd have to describe her as almost like kind of the leader of calling this out at the end. And she also had the nuance. If you listen to what Julia Gillard always said, it was always, it doesn't tell the whole story, but yeah, it tells some of the story. And I just think that framing is correct. So, yes, Jacinta Allen has faced more attacks than I think is normal because she is a woman, 100%. Equally, she can be critiqued about the way she did her job, and it can be correct to move her on as Premier if Victorians aren't very happy with her. All of that could be correct at the same time. And also, just in terms of her record on women, she has a good record on women. And what I mean by that is, you know, she talked about her own endometriosis in terms of, you know, her history of being pro-choice. All of these things that she's sort of done and advocated for, I think not all women agree on all those issues, I want to be clear, but a lot of women view these things as very important and fundamental to our rights and our health, right? So I just think it's a bit more complicated, but you can't say it's not gendered at all. And there's a lot of funny memes going around in my town, a lot of funny stuff about, you know, thank God a white man's going to come in and fix it all, you know, like, so, you know, obviously whenever a woman is a leader, especially a woman of the left, it's sort of a disruptor, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. I think that's true. Let's do zoom out again to the federal sphere, and integrity really has been the headline, I think, that brings federal politics together this week. Anthony Albanese, Angus Taylor and Pauline Hanson all facing their own questions about transparency, sort of keeping it broad. Tom, Angus Taylor was mentioned in the New South Wales ICAC proceedings this week. He's not accused of any wrongdoing. He's not being brought before ICAC at all, but there were claims heard there that senior Liberal figures discussed seeking financial backing for a right-wing factional group in New South Wales called the Reformers, and that Angus Taylor was allegedly said to be prepared to throw some money in. Now, yesterday, Angus Taylor vehemently denied that, denied making any payments or donations.
As I say, I'm not going to give a running commentary on something I'm not party to. No payment was made, and I'll let the commission do its job. As I say, I'm not going to give a running commentary on this. What I'm going to give a running commentary is on our plan, and that's what I'm focused on.
At the same time, Prime Minister Anthony Albanese was under pressure because he attended a dinner at a mansion in Point Piper hosted by a 25-year-old supporter, Felix Lee, and Lee is part of a billionaire family. His father, facing allegations of tax office deception on a pretty grand scale, so that's that. And meanwhile, Pauline Hanson confirmed that billionaire Gina Rinehart had indeed paid for her flights from London to Sicily to be in that lovely Taormina resort, and also her attendance at Dolce & Gabbana fashion show. Pauline Hanson said she personally, though, paid for her own accommodation and her meals and her daily expenses. So wrap it all together, these are very different allegations, but they all raise questions about transparency and payment for access to politicians and feed into that sort of snouts in a trough narrative, which is a very big part of people's disenchantment with politics as it is these days.
It is, and I think it's the wrapping together that, as you say, was the really significant thing this week, because the funny thing about all of these integrity stories, I suppose, as journalists and looking at the kind of things that the public responds to, gee, it's really hard in isolation to get these stories to kind of land with anyone because they're always so technical. I mean, you take both Angus Taylor and the ICAC story and Anthony Albanese and this Felix Lee dinner, you have to just wade through so many conditionals, you know, about Felix Lee and it was his father and then the ATO did this but not this and the proceedings aren't finished, etc. And, you know, and the caveats with Angus Taylor about the degrees of separation, and then everyone's just gone to sleep and it's hard to get people to kind of focus on getting all the way through to the pointy end of these things. But it's when sometimes there are just a few of them that pile up together simultaneously, and this happened a little bit in the late Morrison era as well, that I think it can just start to kind of accumulate, scratch that public sense that, quote, you know, they're all corrupt, and then, you know, add into something that really does matter. And I sense a little bit of that this week, that I'm not sure how much of it comes back onto Hanson and the Gina Rinehart thing, but just the fact that it's happening across the three big parties that we're talking about, and there's just some general sense of muck with all of them, and then you throw together the Victoria CFMEU stuff as well, and I think we're reaching another localized peak of public anger about all of this sort of stuff in general. I think the harder question for us to answer is, what would we like to do about it? Because in the Morrison era, the answer was, let's set up a NAC. But now I think we have this different question of what kind of, how do we want anti-corruption commissions to behave? In New South Wales, we have ICAC, which is probably the most muscular, or definitely the most muscular of all of them. And ICAC just claims scalp after scalp after scalp. And so many senior New South Wales politicians, even with a couple of degrees of separation from wrongdoing probed by ICAC, have fallen on their sword. We have the NAC at the other end of the scale, just essentially totally invisible in terms of the work that it's doing, and having clearly taken more of a focus on public servants and the public sector than on high-profile politicians. And then we have Victoria's IBAC probably somewhere in the middle and due for a strengthening of its powers this week. So where do we want to sit on that spectrum as the public? It's a hard question.
Yeah. Mm. Look, there is a story that's just broken while we've been recording, and if I cannot miss it, it's that bigger deal, I think. The federal member for Solomon, Luke Gosling, has been arrested in relation to an alleged assault on the Northern Territory Administrator David Connolly. Yeah. The ABC's reported the alleged incident occurred at the Thai Festival in Darwin on July the 18th at the time it was reported, but the arrest is the new information. Police began investigating the matter last week and arrested the Labor MP this morning. He is in custody, my friends. Now, one more fact which makes this complicated. In the NT Criminal Code, anyone found guilty of an assault on the NT administrator while he's engaged in the discharge of his official functions, which he clearly was at this festival, could be imprisoned for, are you ready, 14 years.
What?
That is extraordinary. And
now, I got more. Just context. Because I can't help myself. Like, this is now my obsession for the day. You know how I work. Okay. 94-seat majority. If they are forced, and I'm going ahead here, but I'm going to go into a by-election, like this is a real problem for them, yeah?
Yeah.
That'll be freaking fascinating. But also, I mentioned 94-seat majority. I mean, it's not a one-seat majority government where you're like, ah, you know? How are they going to survive this? They've got a really big buffer, but it's very embarrassing, and that's a polite way to put it, isn't it?
Oh, I just think it's worth adding, because this story is breaking, is that Luke Gosling, who's the Labor MP, so everyone understands that, is vehemently denying these allegations. The quote is, "These are ridiculous allegations that I categorically deny," he said in a statement. "I've had no dealings with the administrator since congratulating him following the announcement of his appointment late last year." So there you go.
I think the other really interesting dimension of this is that the NT administrator himself, who's sort of, my understanding is, performs sort of similar to a viceregal kind of function, except that it's not a state, so it's not quite the same, appointed by or chosen by the Northern Territory government, but officially appointed through the federal system and ticked off by the Governor General. And there was some controversy about this appointment because federal Labor didn't like the person who was chosen, a series of comments in general and a sense that he was maybe aligned with conservative views and with the Fonocchiaro government. The Albanese government and the Fonocchiaro government have a very, very tense relationship. It's played out in the last week or two over the Northern Territory government's child protection laws. The federal government said it wasn't going to intervene, but Malindiri McCarthy on Radio National Breakfast this morning was essentially, and Tania Plibersek making similar comments, suggesting that federal government might threaten the Northern Territory government over funding or various agreements and try and make its displeasure known in various ways. There's a brewing storm between these two governments. And there's a lot we don't know about this particular incident, but when I read about it a couple of weeks ago, it seemed like Luke Gosling and the administrator were having some sort of disagreement prior to this.
Big time. And on that funding issue, can I just add, I mean, very senior people like Marcia Langton, very senior Indigenous leader, have called on the Albanese government to intervene into the NT, saying, you know, that basically, what did she say? They're at war with Aboriginal people, she said to me, you know, like, so, yeah. All right.
Back to Earth, PK. Yeah.
Okay.
And something which I think is...
nice Earth up there, by the way, in Darwin.
Explosive, yeah, beautiful. Explosive in its own way is the announcement, and I want to get your thoughts on this, PK, by Hannah Ferguson, who's the founder of Cheek Media, saying that she's going to run against the Prime Minister in Grainler. Now, Hannah Ferguson is a 28-year-old. She's very popular, particularly with progressive young women. There's a, you know, big chunk of Cheek Media in their women's media diets, I understand. I wonder whether you think this is going to put a little fear into the PM's step. What do you think?
I think every politician gets the fear in them, especially in a volatile electorate. So, yes, the answer is yes. I think the thing that's interesting about this is the Greens have been trying to knock off the Prime Minister for a long time. That's why he's always been, you know, in stoushes with the Greens and was very happy to see them lose. You know, I think one of the happiest days of his life was, truthfully, Adam Bandt losing the seat of Melbourne. Not only the happiest day because he won a landslide election, but also just, you know, even the Greens part was part of his happiness, I can assure you. I can confirm it. Right? So that's been his history. So he sees them. And, of course, it's the same tension you're seeing. Like, I'll give you this example. Have you seen anyone who dislikes One Nation as much as Andrew Hastie? I haven't. And the reason, I'll answer my own questions, the reason he's so angry is that One Nation's, well, lots of reasons, but is going after him so personally in his own seat. Same with the PM historically with Greens. So back to Hannah. She provides a sort of left-wing alternative that's not linked to some of the baggage of the Greens, because the Greens also have their own baggage. She's a young woman. Yes, she will motivate lots of women. It's a really interesting play. But again, it's that thing where, you know, progressives get annoyed when other progressives try to knock them off. And maybe Hannah doesn't see the PM as progressive, but, you know, he used to be. He's
well,
just been the PM for a while.
Well, her comment on that was, in fact, pretty sharp, I thought. She said, when she announced, she said, I was born in 1998 in Marrickville, and at that time Anthony Albanese's views were much closer to the views I currently hold.
Ooh.
Them's fighting words.
Good line.
Yeah, I agree with you, PK. I mean, I think I couldn't think of more potent progressive challenger to the PM in Grainler than Hannah Ferguson. Having said that, I do still think it's a pretty outside chance. I think the real trap for him, and one of the things that Hannah Ferguson has mentioned in explaining why she's running, was when the PM called Grace Tame difficult. And I think that his tendency, exactly as you say, and we just think of the way that he used to treat Max Chandler Mather in the parliament, was just this sort of loathing for young progressives and a bit of elbows out, you know, aggression and, okay, you're a politician, you know, I'll go toe-to-toe with you. That's his sort of pugnacious style with this kind of thing. Not sure that any of that kind of tone or response to Hannah Ferguson will play well for him at all. And so the way that he responds to her, if eventually he does have to, if there is some
such
moment that takes off like lightning among that, because that Grace Tame comment still among the kind of demographic that Hannah Ferguson does best with, they haven't forgotten that.
No, and there's a lot of that. There's anyone who doesn't know Grainler, it's a very, you know, I was used to make
it's
a joke
hipster. Let's
to the
put
PM,
it
lots
bluntly.
Of Greeks and gays there, you know, like it's a very kind of progressive, multicultural, queer kind of electorate.
Let
feminist.
Me put it this way. There's a lot of great bakeries there, okay?
That's there's a lot of great bakeries and a lot of good still multicultural food. Like it still has a strong multicultural base. But, yes, it's changing. One more thing I want to say about that. The other problem for the PM with this, as we go into another election cycle, which will happen in sort of the flash of a moment, is whenever you do get a strong challenger, you have to spend too much time defending your own seat, and that's always very time-consuming for a prime minister. I remember being at the end of the Howard government and how many times we used to, because I was on the campaign, have to go to Bedalong as John Howard tried to defend it. You know what I mean? Like it was sort of maddening for him, I could imagine, and then he ended up losing it, right? So it was a neat little end to the government for him in some ways, sad for him but also neat. I think that's the other issue. Just it might sort of have to suck him in. Oh, but he does like Marrickville, so maybe he won't mind so much spending more time there.
And the other thing too is, I mean, he went on Hannah Ferguson's podcast, I think, and, you know, that's the sort of picture he likes to paint of himself as someone who is a little bit hip himself and will go and talk to all these, you know, young podcasters and younger media outlets and all of that. And this kind of just might make that a little bit awkward in some of those meetings.
I think that's right, and I should show my hand here, as even though I might seem spiritually 65, I did recently work for one of these youth social media outlets. That's where I got my journalist start at the Daily Oz, and I can tell you that Labor fancied themselves early adopters of this whole influencer podcast sphere. Yeah. They cottoned on to the idea that there were big audiences of young people and they could get what they were thinking at the time was a pretty soft ride by going on a lot of these platforms. That's really curdled in a couple of directions. Hannah Ferguson's one of them. But these finfluencers as well, who they kept inviting to the budget lockup, who then summarily turned on them over the capital gains tax this year as well. And then they got all of these startup founders angry. It's just not the friendly space for them that they thought it might be, and this is just another dimension of that.
Good point.
It's fascinating. Hey, Tom, I'm so glad we invited you today. It's been a great chat.
Oh, I always have fun. Thanks, Fran and PK. Pleasure.
Thanks, Tom.
And that's it for the Party Room today, but keep sending your questions in because we are very fond of them and we're very into the voice notes, which you can email to thepartyroom@abc.net.au.
And David Spears is back for Insiders on Background on Saturday, and he's speaking to The Australian's Paul Kelly about Paul's new book. And then, PK, of course, you're back with Politics Now from Monday.
I sure am. That's right. Remember to follow Politics Now on ABC Listen so you never miss an episode. See you, Fran.
See you, PK.